Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening on Amazon Music is included with your Prime membership. Just head to amazon.com/adfreenewspodcasts to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Enjoy thousands of Acast shows ad-free for Prime subscribers. Some shows may have ads.
Welcome to your 2023 work recap. This year, you've been to 127 sync meetings. You spent 56 minutes searching for files and almost missed 8 deadlines. Yikes. 2024 can and should sound different. With Monday.com, you can work together easily, collaborate and share data, files, and updates. So all work happens in one place and everyone's on the same page. Go to Monday.com or tap the banner to learn more.
We acknowledge the Yuggera and Kaurna nations as traditional custodians of the land on which we work, live, and learn, and their continuing connection with the land, waters, and community. We pay our respects to them and their elders past and present.
All content related to this program is for general informational purposes only and contains stories and discussion around mental health that may be disturbing to some listeners. If you are concerned about yourself or someone you know, please seek professional and individual advice and support. More details are contained in our show notes.
I've been told my entire life that you can't do that and that's impossible and who the hell do you think you are and you don't know. And so I just don't ever even listen to naysayers. I just tune all that out.
That's New Zealand ultramarathon runner Lisa Tarmody. And this is Reframe of Mind,
where we deep dive into discussions about mental health, joined by some of Australia's leading minds to expand our understanding of the world and ourselves.
Because we don't exist in a vacuum, and the way we talk about mental health shouldn't either.
We're your hosts, Louise Poole and Andy Leroy. And last time we explored the question of what motivates change and considered whether we're mostly approaching change from a perspective of just being done with it.
Lisa Tarmody's life has broad brushstrokes of change throughout, finding strength to meet the challenges of her own personal circumstances to becoming one of New Zealand's most recognisable names through endurance running, and then using everything she learned in the most significant fight of her life, saving her mother's life.
Lisa is a professional ultra-endurance athlete with 25 years' experience running the toughest endurance events in the world, some of which she chatted to us about.
Check out this list of accomplishments for starters, Louise.
Yeah.
Ready?
Yeah.
Over 140 ultramarathons.
I'm exhausted already.
Yeah. She's won national titles. Mm-hmm. She's also won a number of podium places in international races as well. So, you know, when you're talking about a high-performance athlete, Lisa is actually up there with the top of them.
On top of her many expeditions as well, like, she's constantly pushing the limits of human endurance. She's authored 2 international best-selling running books and is a much sought-after motivational speaker, running coach, and mindset expert.
Yeah, it'd be easy to assume someone like Lisa never struggled a minute with self-esteem, body image, weight problems, lack of talent, depression, fear and anxiety.
But this is Reframe of Mind. Mm-hmm. If you don't know by now, we're not here to just hold up tidy images of perfection as toxic. If they can, you can too. Our guests have all approached this project with sincerity and authenticity, willing to share their low points as well.
Lisa's journey was one of learning how to achieve the unattainable, and she now passionately shares her learnings on how to achieve the extraordinary and how to beat the odds.
A good shortcut is only valuable when you truly appreciate the path that you're choosing to divert. And Lisa happily shared the details of the longer path from her own perspective.
So this is a woman who has run 217 kilometres non-stop through Death Valley. And the 2,250-kilometre length of New Zealand.
Amazing. She's canoed down the Canadian Yukon, cycled toured through over 25 countries, and illegally crossed the Libyan desert in an expedition that was completed without support through uncharted territory.
Yeah, that's a scary story she'll get into a bit later. So she's now in her 50s, and she still brings the same energy into everything she does. So where did this passion for human endurance start for Lisa 30-odd years ago?
I grew up really outdoorsy in New Zealand in the 1970s, and, you know, so being tough and cool and, you know, handling stuff was a part of my family's DNA. I had a very tough dad, if you like. But in my early 20s, I met a guy from Austria who was an extreme athlete, and he was into traveling the world, and we got together and we cycled the world, and we, you know, climbed mountains and trekked and did all those sort of adventurous stuff things. I wasn't into running per se. I did it for fitness, but I didn't do, you know, anything long distance. And I was actually hopeless at running. I was an asthmatic since I was a little kid. I broke my back when I was 21. I didn't have the right body shape to be a runner. But the reason I got into running ultramarathons and deserts in particular was that I actually did an expedition across the Libyan desert, which was an illegal expedition across this really dangerous, but amazingly beautiful desert on the border area between Libya and Egypt, with the boyfriend at the time and then two other guys. And this was an unsupported expedition. We only had like 2 liters of water a day each, because that's all we could carry. And then we had to cover 250 kilometers odd and do sort of 45 kilometers a day. And we had massive backpacks, so like 35 kilo backpacks. And so we physically couldn't really take much more. And we only had this very limited water supply. So this was a really crazy and, dare I say, stupid undertaking back then. And this was a really big turning point in my life, because the relationship that I'd been in for 5 years, it was a very abusive relationship. I'll just say it what it is. It was. And in the middle of this desert, without going into all the details of it, the leader of the expedition was not pleased how I was being treated by this guy. And he sort of stood up for me and said, hey, you can't treat her like that, you know. And we're all in dire straits here. We're extremely dehydrated, extremely irritable, you know, like we're pushing the limits, literally. And the boyfriend decides to leave me in the middle of that desert. And literally, that, you know, end a 5-year relationship when you're in dire straits, like we could have died. That was that, you know, dire. And he did. He left. He left. And I was left with the other two guys, thank goodness. And we managed to get through. And you'll have to read my book, Running Hot, for that whole story. But yeah, that was a real big turning point in my life, where I'd been through this terrible relationship for many years that had become very abusive over time. And I was constantly being told I was hopeless and useless and couldn't do anything. And, you know, I had bad genes, for goodness sake. I was hopeless at everything. And when I got out of that desert and I managed to get out of the relationship, a very long story, but then I had this burning desire to prove him wrong. And so I read about this race in Morocco called the Marathon des Sables, which is a really famous ultra marathon that's been going for a long, long time. And it was touted back then as the toughest race on earth. And it was 240 kilometers. And I'm like, you know, come out of this Libyan desert. I'd been very ill and had lots of problems, both mental problems and physical problems after that. But I was reading about this desert and I thought, this race, and I thought I could do that, because comparatively it was nothing, you know, like compared to what I'd just been through. So I'm like, oh, I've never run a marathon, but I reckon I could do this. And so I signed up for this race, and in me was this burning desire really to prove that I could do something, you know, that I wasn't useless. And so signed up, trained, didn't know what the heck I was doing, and went down and did this race, managed to get some sponsors. It was the most incredible event of my life, you know, because the people that I was surrounded by were so positive. I mean, there were 700 runners from all around the world, and you're doing this in very difficult race, you know, over 7 days, and you're carrying your backpacks, but they were only 9 kilos, not sort of 35 kilos, and you got 9 liters of water a day. And it was like, wow, this is awesome. And you had support from doctors, and you know, everything was there and a bit more controlled. And I had this wonderful experience there, did really, really well, ended up in the top 10 in the women's division. And I was just like, wow, I'm not hopeless. I'm not as useless as I've been told I am. And so from there on, I just basically got addicted and just wanted one after the other. So that's how I got into it, in a nutshell, a very, very short nutshell.
So since working for ourselves from home, it dawned on me that I packed much more into my mornings than I ever used to when I attended the workplace. And I seem to remember that once upon a time, all I ever craved was just to rest.
But now, speaking of people like Lisa Tarmady, a high-powered athlete, and realising how your mornings actually look, now you've got the opportunity to just rest. You've started to wonder whether the downtime that we seem to crave is actually what we need or really want.
I think we often crave leisure time that we don't actually want in the end, or, you know, downtime that we don't actually want in the end. It's finding that balance.
It's very much, we do need recovery. So, yeah, I do want to preface what I've just said about pushing outside your comfort zone. You need to branch out and push yourself, and then you need to come back and recover. And that recovery piece of the puzzle is also very important. So, you know, while you're hard charging and you're going for it and you're getting big results like you are at the moment, you do need to remember that biology is such that it likes to be in push and pull. So it likes to be cyclic. In everything that I've studied in biology and neuroscience, it seems to be that we want to push hard, then we want to recover, and we want to eat well, and then we want to fast. We want to push our exercise, and then we want a recovery phase. You know, and you do periodized training is set up all that way. And that, I think this cyclic nature is what we actually need as human beings. So while it's really important to push hard, and I find too, and you may find this, like in the early morning hours, that's when I get a lot of my intellectual work done, the heavy sort of stuff, because I know that in the afternoon my brain isn't so quite so switched on, and so I'm not going to get the best results. So understanding my own biology, my own genetics, my own predispositions, and that's, you know, what I do when I study, then I can get the best out of my body at all times. I also know that if I go training in the afternoon, I'm probably going to have a better output in that respect. So I think that recovery piece of the puzzle needs to be talked about more as well. So I see a lot of hard-charging type A elite athletes and corporate people and business people who are, you know, go hard or go home all the time. And I was definitely wired that way, and I'm still wired that way, but I have to really pay attention to my own biology now that I'm getting older, and I need to understand how to get the most out of the time I have, and to not burn myself out, because I've done that 100 times, you know, where I've gone to the point of blowing myself up and then collapsed and then got back up again and then smashed yourself again. And it's avoiding that crash now. Is one of my goals. So I wouldn't say like balance is easy to find, but having that push and pull and that time out and not feeling guilty for taking a little bit of time as well. You know, like a half an hour, just, you know, as an example, a half an hour spent staring at the waves on the beach is a half hour really well spent. You may think, oh, but I should have been training for an extra half an hour, or I should have smashed out a few more emails, or I should have done this or that. But that downtime for the brain will mean that you will bring more when you come back to the office or back to the gym or back to your training. You'll actually perform at a much higher level than if you're just pushing it all the time.
So high-profile, highly accomplished sports people know their worth, right?
Mm.
Because they're the ones we turn to for those catchphrases of, yes, I can, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So it's curious then why, after performing at such a high and successful level, why did Lisa not feel duly proud? Mm. I mean, as it turns out, confidence doesn't mean that you don't have self-doubt.
I was doing a race in the Himalayas once, and it was a 222K race. It was horrifically difficult at extreme altitude, extreme temperatures. And I've got a doc on, and if anyone wants to watch it, I can send them a link. And I remember, you know, getting to the end of this thing, achieving this, you know, which is the culmination of 18 months or so of hard work and amazing team and all the rest of it. And I got to the finish line in 53 hours and 5 minutes. One of my teammates on the ride back home just said to me, my crew, he said, "You're amazing. That's just so epic and just amazing." And I just said, "Hey, no, so-and-so was better and someone else was faster and there's a longer race and blah, blah, blah." And he just went, "Oh, for frick's sake. Can't you just actually celebrate what you just achieved and live in the moment right now and actually bank that one? Because that was big, you know, and if you can't bank that, you're not banking anything, and therefore you're just going through life being dissatisfied and never happy with yourself, no matter what you do." And, I mean, that's a damn long way to run, 222Ks at extreme altitude. And I had every right to congratulate myself, and yet I still wasn't doing that. And I really took that to heart and started to change that. you know, and not just for the big things, but for the little things as well that I do right, because that makes me a happier, healthier, and more resilient, stronger individual. Overall.
We've explored the value of stepping out of your comfort zone with guests like former South Australian Star Force officer Derek McManus earlier in the season. If you haven't caught our conversation with him yet, skip back to episode 12. You can hear more on that.
And Lisa's experiences led her to the same conclusion about the value of extending outside of our comfort zone.
Every time you do push yourself outside your comfort zone and you're going into the unknown, whether it's, you know, running a desert or starting a business or doing a degree or whatever it is, you're going to learn an awful lot, and you're going to develop and you're going to grow. There is no guarantees of success, but there is this chance for growth and development. And when you actually achieve something like, you know, finishing that race, it lifts your horizon as to what you're capable of and what's possible. And then from there on in, you're like, well, if I managed that, maybe I could do this. And then your world just slowly opens up if you keep pushing outside that comfort zone, you know. So we all like, you know, if I'm talking to a room full of people and I ask them, you know, how many of you want to live your full potential and be the best that you can be, and you know, everyone puts their hands up. And if I say, okay, and how many of you want to change and to go through hardship and sacrifice, and nobody puts their hand up, right? Because they want the result, they don't want the hard part. But we have to understand that when we risk and we push outside that place where we're comfortable, that's when we're going to find out lots and lots of things about ourselves, and we're going to change and we're going to develop. We might fall on our faces, that happens as well, and I've certainly failed on many occasions. But in any case, you're always going to be more, you're going to have more experience, more confidence, more things to learn and take away. And even from the failures that I've had, those have been, horrible in the moment, in the immediate aftermath often. When you look back over time and you have the advantage of perspective, you look back and you go, wow, that was the biggest learning curve of my life, you know, or that was just incredible what I actually developed from that. So I think it's very important that we, no matter what our age is, and this is very important, I think, for older people, that they never stop pushing their boundaries, that they never give in to just being comfortable and wanting comfort. Because from a biological standpoint, we are wired for comfort because we had very harsh, rough lives back in the caveman days, if you like. And so, of course, we were going to search out comfort and food and easy times. But we would never actually, like in our modern world now, we have comfort all around us. You know, we have, you know, comfortable houses and comfortable, we have food on every street corner. We're not starving. We have clothing. We have all these things. And if we don't push outside, then we're just going to shrink, really. You know, we're going to, you know, not develop as our full potential. That's my opinion to it anyway.
With so much success in her rearview mirror, while her public profile grew, life threw a curveball to Lisa, with much more at stake than she'd ever faced before.
5 years ago, my mum had a massive aneurysm. I don't know if you know that story or not, but yeah. So she was left at the age of 74, well, fighting for her life for a starter. They didn't think she'd survive. When she did, she was in and out of coma for a number of weeks. And when she did survive and come out the other end of the coma, she had massive brain damage and hardly any higher function mentally. So she had no control over her body or anything. Now, I'm suddenly confronted, you know, I've been up until that point this, you know, selfish, goal-orientated athlete. Mum was always supporting me and, you know, looking out for me and helping me. I was running my businesses and so on, but I was very much, I could do what I wanted. And then this situation happened and we were left, you know, being told that she would never do anything again, that the brain damage was so massive she would never have any quality of life or do anything, and to put her in an institution. And I was just like, no, that's not happening. And so at that point, I had to stop training and running, obviously, and doing the long stuff. I still looked after myself, self-care-wise, but I put all of my energies and focus into her rehabilitation. And even though I was told there was no hope and there is no way forward and just forget it, make it comfortable, I thought, well, I don't do comfortable for a start. And if that's the option, then I'd rather go down fighting if I'm going to go down. So I started to research and study, and I came across something called hyperbaric oxygen therapy, which was hugely beneficial in her case with a brain injury and a very underrated therapy in general. And I got her access to this, and she couldn't even sit or put food in her mouth or chew or speak or know who I am. She had nothing. I've spent now 5.5 years. It took me 2.5 years basically to get her back to normal. Thousands and thousands of hours of retraining her brain, studying neuroplasticity, epigenetics, functional neurology, physio, you name it, I studied it and stayed one step ahead of her in her rehabilitation process. And at every step of the way, especially in the early stages, I would get criticized to hell by people telling me, like, why are you putting her through such an arduous, torturous regime? Because what I was doing was quite difficult, you know, it was harsh. And she had to relearn things from scratch. So it was just absolutely sometimes really, really tough to watch the stuff I had to put her through. But I knew that the alternative was death. And so that for me was just that's not an option. I'm gonna throw everything at this thing, or I'm gonna get it back or die trying, was my attitude. So I went all in. And it nearly broke me. I had my own health dramas that I went through in that period of time because I just blew myself to pieces. But I got my mum back, and now she's off right now at an art course, studying. She's driven into town and she's got her full driver's license. She's, living her life again full. And I've written a book called Relentless, How a Mother and Daughter Defied the Odds. And it's a really empowering book, and it's a mindset book above all. It's our story, and it's a story of all the therapies and all the stuff I studied. But more than that, it's about the attitude. When you're up against all the odds and when everybody's telling you there is no way forward, they're not always right. And that if you're up against it and you have no other options, why not throw the bus at this, and go all in? And that was, especially when you love somebody, there's a pretty big motivating factor there. And so that's what I did. And now, my mum is just loving life again. And I think that's an example of resilience and an example of being able to adapt to change, And we're still, in that process, but it is. And that's why the book's called Relentless, because I had to be relentless. Mm. And I'm still relentless. Like, she has never has a day off training. Never, birthdays, Christmas, whatever. She's training every day, and she has to because she's now 79 and I need to keep her there. And I'm determined to keep her there and as healthy for as long as I possibly can because I selfishly want my mum around,
Yeah. That is really such an incredible story of recovery and persistence and resilience. And I don't know, there are probably a million words I could use for how in awe I am of that story. I had an auntie when I was 7 years old die as a result of an aneurysm. Oh. And I can only imagine over the years, kind of in my own ways would think that, if someone had taken the time or taken the chance, maybe she could have recovered. Yeah. And we'll
if
never know that.
If they had the knowledge back then too,
Yeah. I wonder, with all of the voices and all of the people against you, I can only imagine people saying, this can never happen, you're wasting your time, just make it comfortable. Was it a case for you that you felt like you wanted to prove them wrong as well? Did it come back to that attitude for you, or was there something else there that helped to drive you and your mum?
I mean, the main driver was love, and that my mum and my family are always my number one priority in everything I do. But there's definitely, when I was told there is no way, I've been told my entire life that you can't do that and that's impossible and who the hell do you think you are and you don't know. And so I just don't ever even listen to naysayers. I just tune all that out. And I think I definitely have a rebel spirit. I do like proving people wrong, and I use that as a motivating force sometimes. When I'm in despair and when I don't think I can carry on, I think of that person who just told me I couldn't, and I go, well, you're going to let them prove you them right, or are you going to keep going? And I certainly did that in running. With mum, it was easy to be motivated because, I was just desperate. And she was, just an amazing mother, just a phenomenal mother my entire life. So she'd picked up the pieces and put me back together 100 times. And, you know, there was no way I wasn't going to try to get her back, you know. And unfortunately, I had a another situation recently. I lost my father, and my father was he was just her rock too during this whole rehabilitation. And I'm just so grateful that my father got to see her come back to full health before we lost him. And I fought with everything I had with for him as well. I mean, he had a different situation. He had an aneurysm in the stomach, and you know, happened out of the blue, as these things do. I fought with everything I had in the hospital to get him, in his case, intravenous vitamin C, because he developed sepsis off the back of the operation. And I just came up, and I knew the research around vitamin C and sepsis, and we were running out of options. My dad was dying, and they wouldn't let me do it. And I fought for 15 days against legal committees, you know, legal ethics committees and legal battles to be allowed to give my father intravenous vitamin C when they didn't have any other options. And why could I not throw everything at it? But because he was in critical care, whereas my mum, I managed to get her home, you know, and when she was home, I could do whatever, you know, she was stable enough that I could do everything that I did for her. With my dad being in critical care, I'd lost control because he was, you know, in the ICU and on a respirator, and I had no jurisdiction and no ability to give him anything. So even though he was dying, they had no other options. I had an option, but they wouldn't let me do it. I did eventually win the case, but it was 15 days into the battle, and my dad had by then multiple organ failure. And despite that, the very first one started to turn all his markers around. His CRP, which is an inflammatory marker, his white blood cell counts improved, his kidney function improved, but I needed it every 6 hours, which was the protocol that I'd been fighting for. But they stopped me doing the second, the third, the fourth, and the, you know, and every time I had an 18-hour battle to get the next one in, and it was by then just too late and too far gone. And so this is an example of the exact opposite. I threw everything that I had at that situation as well. I blew myself to pieces for 16 days. I stood by his bedside. I hardly took an hour out, except when I'd just pass out in the, you know, for a couple of hours of sleep and then back into it. And yet I lost that battle, you know. You roll the dice when you go into these situations like these, and these are extreme situations, I know, but the learnings from these are just as powerful, because, you know, I cannot guarantee when I'm working with someone. I work with people with strokes and, you know, that type of thing, or difficult health journeys. And people often say to me, well, how long will it take before this works? And I'm like, I can't tell you. And if you have that attitude, you're not going to get there. You have to be willing to put the hard yards in and risk failure despite all that. But have you got any other alternatives? If you don't, then this is the only way forward, if you're willing to go through and sacrifice what it will take to do this. And that's the conversations that I find really difficult when people don't have what it takes to push through those barriers. And that makes me so sad, you know, because there are, you know, especially in the rehabilitation space, there are people that could have come back, that could have survived, that could have maybe had a chance had they been given the right resources, the right information. And a lot of that information is already out in the world. It's not like we're waiting for stuff. This is stuff that's already known, but not necessarily available in your local, you know, hospital or your local doctors. And that's not their fault. It's just that the world is changing so rapidly, the research is going so fast, that no one person can keep up with it. But if you're willing to put in the hard yards, you might have a chance of finding somebody in the world who's fixed this before or helped with this. So yeah, another very rough story, that one.
I've had a couple of experiences in my life where people close to me have been told they have cancer. Mm-hmm. And the way that they've reacted to that knowledge, and I suppose what happens in between whether they make a recovery or don't make a recovery, I think has really varied on how they've taken that diagnosis.
Yep, absolutely.
So my father, he was told that, and he was very much wouldn't accept it, but he fought, but also it was I'm trying to think of how to phrase it, but it was like a superficial fight. Like he said he was fighting, but he gave up, and I could see that the depression around that was significant. And so I wasn't surprised when he checked out, and that was how that ended. But I've also known people it's just
life sucks sometimes,
it's just how it is. But but then I've also known people who, you know, my partner's father currently has cancer and is still alive, but his attitude is different. And I mean, it ultimately everything results in the same ending, no matter what
we're
we
all
do.
Gonna die,
yeah. So, but I really think that the recovery, like, and doctors do us a disservice when they say, you know, you're terminal or this has no options or your chance of survival is slim, because I think that that sets us up for that mindset where we give up before we've even tried.
Yeah, there's been studies done on this, you know, and there's been cases where people have been diagnosed with terminal, you know, cancer and told that you're going to die in 3 months. And then they've died and then cut them open and realised they had no cancer. It was a misdiagnosis from, you know, some mistake along the way, but they've died anyway. In other words, our brain and our body are very connected, and what we put into our brain affects our body. And we haven't elucidated all the mechanisms by which that works. And there's some amazing research out there on how this does happen. And I for one just think that if we, you know, go in with the attitude, you know, that we're going to be open to the go and do the research, go and look at the stuff, find somebody to help you to do that if you're not in a position to do that, if you can, because, you know, like cancer is one of those things that, you know, the metabolic approach to cancer versus the genetic approach to cancer, I mean, that alone is a huge, you know, big, ugly conversation that we could get into. But there are different approaches, you know, is what I'm trying to say. And there are things, you know, intravenous vitamin C, as I mentioned before, for sepsis has tons of studies around it in regards to cancer. But you go to your local oncologist and he's liable to say, well, if you touch that, I'm not treating you. Instead of being open to looking at this as an adjunctive therapy, for example, or they just very much, no, it's my way or the highway. You know, chemotherapy and radiotherapy and things have their place, but it's not the only approach. And if we look at the metabolic approach to cancer, then, you know, if I got cancer, I know exactly what I would be doing. You know, I know exactly the therapies and stuff that I would be putting into place alongside of considering all those other conventional things. And, you know, and luckily I haven't got cancer, so I, you know, I can speak like that. But I have done a lot of research on that because I know that it's one of the biggest killers. And therefore I need to know if it's going to hit one of my family or one of my friends or whatever, that I can help in some way, shape or form, or I'm aware of the research. And there is a lot of research out there. And, you know, you can find great books on this, you know, the metabolics, the Otto Warburg, Nobel Prize winning scientist back in the 30s who, you know, really studied the whole mitochondria and the metabolic effects of, you know, just things like cutting out glucose and things that can have a big effect. And I don't want to bastardize the science, but in other words, even amongst doctors and things, there is not a consensus always. So go and get second opinions, third opinions, look outside the box. We have access now via the internet to the greatest minds on the planet. Find out what their latest is, because your local person may not be aware of those things. And then it depends on your, you know, everybody's situation is very, very different, and you can never, like, you know, my mum's situation and getting her back, I can't go and just replicate that anywhere, because I cannot tell you which of the things that I did was the successful, you know, thing. I threw a lot of mud at the wall, you know. It was do this, do this, do this, do this. And I had to do it all at once just to get progress. And I had to be willing to sacrifice thousands and thousands of hours into her rehabilitation. And not everybody has that ability or the chance to do that. So everybody's situation is different. But I just want to give people the the chance to reflect on and being empowered to think outside the square and to maybe take responsibility for your own health rather than just giving it up to any person, any one person, and doing your own research, you know. That's the area that I work in a lot at the moment.
Seems to me that there's a very strong message here, Lisa, around agency and personal power within a situation to be able to take control and say, well, you might be saying this, but I'm going to try this, and give yourself more options and more ways to try and prove it wrong. Are there situations you think where we can't actually take that agency for ourselves, or do you think that there's always a way for us to find even the smallest part of power for ourselves?
I think there's always something we can do. You know, like the situation with Dad in the ICU, I didn't have any agency. And that was very, very, more than frustrating. It was, horrific for me. And I felt robbed of the chance to do something. And I didn't feel listened to. And I felt like, you're not a doctor, what would you know? And that's just, they no longer hold the keys to the castle. We can go and find our own research. It's not like when 30 years ago when we had to belong to a medical library in order to get the resources. We all have that now. And just to dismiss it as, oh, that's just internet research, it's the best stuff is out, in PubMed and clinical studies. And, and I go and get the best scientists in the world on my podcast. So, don't tell me I don't know what I'm talking about. When I go and research a particular area, you can bet that within a couple of weeks, I'll have a fair idea of what the heck I'm talking about. But not everybody has that ability to go, to that level of research. Where I like to really focus my efforts in now is in the prevention space, because I can actually do something before something happens if I can, and we can't get rid of all risks. We can't, who knows, like the aneurysm for my dad in the stomach. I never saw that one coming. I was already working on other areas of his health, but I didn't see that one, So you can't be across everything. But just being in that space of prevention where you're looking after the health fundamentals, you're getting your sleep right, you're working, and these are all works in progress, but, trying to do things properly, eating good nutrition, good sleep, good amounts of exercise, the right nutrients, looking at what deficiencies you might have, getting your bloods tested. I would like to see everybody get their bloods tested at least 3 times a year. Our basic panels, which are very cheap to do and could help prevent a heck of a lot of things happening, before people just go, for 2 years and don't get a blood test. And it's like, would you not get a warrant of fitness for your car? Like our dashboards in our car tell us, especially in the modern cars, tell us more about what's happening in the motor than we know about our own bodies. We're getting that feedback all the time. What's the petrol tank like, and has the oil okay, and is there electrical fault somewhere, and the computer's telling you something's wrong? We know more about our cars than our own bodies. So I do things like monitor my blood sugar levels. I do HRV every morning. I do cold showers. I have a whole morning routine that I do every day. I'm very aware that with my genetics and my personality, that I'm very prone to stress and doing too much. So I, try to prioritize meditation and, having downtime. All of these little bits of pieces that we do on a daily basis really adds up to being a healthier, stronger, fitter, younger individual, despite the date on your birth certificate. I mean, I'm 52 now. But, to be honest, I'm in better shape now than I was at 20, because I know how to manage my body better and what it needs. And I'm just a lot more aware of things,
It seems as well that there's a difference in your thinking compared to, say, a medical, one of those doctors that we're kind of talking about. There's a rigidity in their thinking, but you, because you're more open to change, it's you've got that willingness to look beyond what it is. Do you think that's a skill we can learn?
Yeah, and I think, you know, I don't want to slam doctors. Gosh, we need them.
No, no, no. Absolutely, we love doctors.
But yes, we do.
But when people but are focused only on that science, it kind of puts that wall in front of their face.
The area that I have problems with is the rigidity of it, and that the conventional approach versus even the functional medicine and integrated sort of medicine approach are very, very different. And now there's even more developments coming off even further from that. And then there's the whole biohacking, you know, space that I'm definitely in. Just knowing that you don't know everything and that you may have been schooled in a particular way, but it's almost like buying into a religion and only your way is the right way. And I don't buy into that, not in the religious sense and not in a medical sense either. There is no just one way. It is whatever the science is telling us is the, you know, the latest and greatest in science is what I'm listening to now, you know, not what was taught 20 years ago and not what was taught in only in this direction because we want to sell pharmaceuticals, but what is the actual, the state of affairs? And, you know, this, I mean, we could get into a very deep conversation is like, why is there no clinical or very little clinical studies done on things like hyperbaric oxygen therapy? Well, I can tell you why, because nobody can make money out of it. Nobody can make money out of intravenous vitamin C. And so, because the clinical trials and the system that's been set up is very, very expensive. So who are the people that can afford to do the research? Pharmaceutical companies can. And they're not going to do that and invest the billions that it takes to get through with something that they can't make back. And that's just logical. That's not demonizing them or anything. That's just, you know, the state of affairs. So I think we need another approach, another model of why we need to do this research. I mean, I've got a professor coming on my podcast just in an hour, and he very much is in agreement on this sort of area that we, you know, it's not always about pharmacological interventions. Perhaps we can start to do the stuff that's harder to sell, though. You know, like when it comes to lifestyle interventions and controlling our diet and our exercise, we don't want to hear that. We want to get a magic pill. And I think that problem lies with us in our approach, that we're conditioned to think that if I get sick, I go to the doctor, I get a little pill, and I'll be fine again. And that approach just is not realistic and not a good one to have as a mindset. We need to understand that, you know, we need to honor our biology and the way how we've evolved, and you know, like we need sunlight. We need, you know, like I was saying to you before, with your sleep, make sure you get that early morning sunshine. Yeah. You know, on your eye, on your retina. I mean, don't look into the sun, but just go. You know what I mean? Get that exposure so you get that cortisol release in the early morning hours, so you get that circadian rhythm reset, so that you sleep better the next night, so that you've got energy and alertness during the day. These are things that we should be being taught, and we are being taught them now. You know, on the internet and in certain circles, but why isn't this part of our general education? These lifestyle interventions that are very, very simple to do. And we, you know, sleep is just one of those things we should be talking about. Young women should be taught about their menstrual cycles. All we're taught is how to use a tampon and what if to that. Expect. If that.
Yeah.
I didn't even get that
no,
one.
No, I didn't get that one. No.
Took me ages to work that one out. But you know what I mean? It's like, why are we not educated on all the variations in our hormones throughout the monthly cycle, and what happens when you go on the pill, and how it shuts down just a whole section of your biology, and why it affects your gut, and, you know, all of these things that we need to be knowing in order to make informed consent about what we are actually wanting to do.
I'm going to do a little circuit breaker here and say thanks for listening to us. If you love the show, let us know. Hit the subscribe button on your podcast app and show us those 5-star ratings. Remember to tell your friends about us and check our Patreon page for access to even more content, like extended interviews at patreon.com/reframeofmind. The more people we get talking about mental health, the more supported we'll all be.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your favorite show? Good news. Ad-free listening on Amazon Music is included with your Prime membership. Download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/adfreesports. That's amazon.com/adfreesports to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads. Enjoy thousands of Acast shows ad-free for Prime members. Some shows may have ads.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Seems to me that there's a very strong message here, Lisa, around agency and personal power within a situation to be able to take control and say, well, you might be saying this, but I'm going to try this, and give yourself, you know, more options and more ways to try and prove it wrong. Are there situations, you think, where we can't actually take that agency for ourselves, or do you think that there's always a way for us to find even the smallest part of power for ourselves?
I think there's always something we can do, you know, like the situation with Dad in the ICU, I didn't have any agency. And that was very, very, more than frustrating. It was, you know, horrific for me. And I felt robbed of the chance to do something. And I didn't feel listened to. And I felt like, oh, you're not a doctor, what would you know? And that's just, they no longer hold the keys to the castle. We can go and find our own research. It's not like when, you know, 30 years ago when we had to belong to a medical library in order to get the resources. We all have that now. And just to dismiss it as, oh, that's just internet research. It's the best stuff is out, you know, in PubMed and clinical studies, and you know, and I go and get the best scientists in the world on my podcast. So, you know, don't tell me I don't know what I'm talking about. When I go and research a particular area, you can bet that within a couple of weeks, I'll have a fair idea of what the heck I'm talking about. But not everybody has that ability to go, you know, to that level of research. Where I like to really focus my efforts in now is in the prevention space, because I can actually do something before something happens if I can, you know, and we can't get rid of all risks. We can't, you know. Who knows? You know, like the aneurysm for my dad in the stomach, I never saw that one coming. I was already working on other areas of his health, but I didn't see that one, you know. So you can't be across everything. But just being in that space of prevention where you're looking after the health fundamentals, you're getting your sleep right, you know, you're working, and these are all works in progress, but, you know, trying to do things properly, eating good nutrition, good sleep, good amounts of exercise, the right nutrients, looking at what deficiencies you might have, getting your bloods tested. I would like to see everybody get their bloods tested at least 3 times a year. You know, our basic panels, which are very cheap to do and could help prevent a heck of a lot of things happening, you know, before where people just go, you know, for 2 years and don't get a blood test. And it's like, would you not get a warrant of fitness for your car? Like, our dashboards in our car tell us, especially in the modern cars, tell us more about what's happening in the motor than we know about our own bodies. We're getting that feedback all the time, you know, what's the petrol tank like, and has the oil okay, and is the, you know, is there electrical fault somewhere, and the computer's telling you something's wrong. We know more about our cars than our own bodies. So, you know, I do things like monitor my blood sugar levels. I, you know, do a HRV every morning. I, you know, do cold showers. I have a whole morning routine that I do every day. I'm very aware that with my genetics and my personality, that I'm very prone to stress and doing too much. So I, you know, try to prioritize meditation and, you know, having downtime. You know, all of these little bits of pieces that we do on a daily basis really adds up to being a healthier, stronger, fitter, younger individual, despite the, you know, the date on your birth certificate. I mean, I'm 52 now, but, you know, to be honest, I'm in better shape now than I was at 20, because I know how to manage my body better, and what it needs. And I'm just a lot more aware of things, you know.
From a general point of view, though, do you think that speaks to, I suppose, our societal, that we don't take our own personal power. We expect somebody else to have a fix for us. And and so we do spend as a society a lot of time unhappy and feeling powerless because we keep assigning that to an outside force.
Yeah, and that's exactly my point, is that we need to be in that whole taking ownership over our own health. Mm. Okay, I can't do surgery on myself. I can't, you know, if I'm in extreme pain or I break my leg, I need a doctor to intervene, but I can look after my health to the best of my ability, you know, and I'm always like an 80-20 rule person. If I get 80% right, then good, I've done okay today. You know, we don't have to go for perfection, but we need to be like aware of how things affect our body and what we need to be doing. And some of it's so easy and can relieve so much suffering. You know, like if I spend an hour with you just talking through different sleep hygiene things, that could make a massive difference in your life already.
Yeah.
You know, and it's very easy and simple things to do. They're not rocket science. You just need to be told about them, you know, or educated on them. And I'd like to see a lot more educational programs in our schools and in just in our general public conversations that we're having, that we're talking about health fundamentals. You know, we're told often, oh, don't eat cakes. And you go, okay, I know cakes and biscuits are bad for me, but I want you to understand the mechanisms, why they're bad for you and what they're doing in your body. Because if I can teach you that, it doesn't have to be to the PhD level, but I can give you a simple explanation, which I'm sure there's people that can do that. You may go, oh, okay. So it's not just, this is what it's actually doing in my body. And then you're more likely to think about the consequences when you understand the mechanisms of action, is my opinion.
And you know, knowledge, like, I've got a personal power.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I've got a brother who's, who will listen to anything I tell him to do, but he won't listen to the science behind it because he says, oh, I haven't got the brain for that. I don't want to know that. Just tell me what to do. And my argument is always, yes, but if you understand the why, then you'll be able to make the decisions to tweak and change it to adapt it to your personal situation because you understand the mechanism behind it and you understand why you're doing it rather than I've just told you not to do it or to do it. You know, and it has much more power for you to make your own decisions when you understand the actual mechanisms behind it to a certain degree. It doesn't have to be, you know, like I said, university level stuff. It's just understanding it to a good degree so that you know why you're being told. You know, like when I was in school, I remember, you know, maths, and I was struggling with maths and I was like, why do I have to learn all these, I don't know, whatever it was, algebra or something. And I was never told in what application this would have for me. So I didn't invest my time in it. And I didn't, you know, I just went, nah, it's too hard, not learning it, you know. Whereas later on, I'm like, oh, that's why I needed to learn that, you know, because then you couldn't do something, you know, that was actually practical in your life. In other words, if we'd explained it as to why you're learning this stuff, then it would make more sense. Then I'm more likely to put the effort into actually learning it and doing the hard yards.
I wonder how we go about rebuilding confidence in ourselves and listening to ourselves and stop comparing ourselves necessarily to other people. But maybe, you know, when I've done yoga classes, this is years ago, mind you, because I haven't done them recently, but the instructor would always say, don't compare yourself to other people in the room, compare yourself to yourself. Do we need to take more of that kind of approach when we're looking at these sorts of things for ourselves, Lisa?
Absolutely, and that's a really good point because in our society, the way, you know, with social media the way it is, and especially our young people, but even as adults, I mean, I see myself, you know, can get sucked down into that hole of that person's better than me, you know, scenario just when you're scrolling through a social media feed. And, you know, it's very, very important that we understand that from a genetic point of view, we are all very, very different. And I study epigenetics, I teach epigenetics, I have a program in our business that we use, and it's very powerful because it helps people understand who they are, how they tick, and how to optimize their whole life, you know, right from their food to their exercise to the timings that they do things to their brain function, their mood and behavior. All of these areas are covered. And it's a real, like, aha. I see so many people have an aha moment, you know, because they're like, I've been dieting for years and I've trained so hard and I'm keep putting on weight and I don't know what's wrong. I hear that every single day. And then we do the epigenetics assessments and the genetic testing, and we come back and say, like, well, you've been doing it at the wrong time of the day, the wrong type of exercise, and you've been eating what are ostensibly healthy foods, but they're not healthy foods for you. You know, so if we change that to this, and we change your timings of your exercise to this time, and you understand what times of the day your hormones are replacing, you know, is an example, then you can all of a sudden you get people getting results. And, you know, like before we did this is in the fitness industry, we used to have a one size fits all approach. You know, everybody get up at 6 a.m. and do a CrossFit class if you really want to lose weight. Well, I can tell you, if I had a CrossFit class at 6 a.m. and I was controlling what you ate as well, and I was giving you 6 meals a day, I can tell you about 4, you know, out of a class of, say, 12, 4 of them will get fabulous results, 4 of them will get nothing, and 4 of them will get fatter and get injuries with the same program and the same food. In other words, we all need very different inputs in order to get optimize the outputs. And having that knowledge has now been game changing for us as coaches, because now I can go, okay, this is your genetics. Therefore, we need to train you in this way, in this manner. Give you a quick example. So I used to make my husband just do that, get up at 6 a.m. and do a CrossFit class. Now, for his genetics, I didn't realize back then that his hormones are replacing themselves and doing the regulation at around 5 to 6 a.m. in the morning, so he should be asleep at that time. Then his body type and his health type, if you like, is so set up that he should be doing his training later in the day, if possible, because that's when he's going to get the best muscle contractility, the best cardio output. And he should not be doing a CrossFit style workout, because that his ATP doesn't replace as quickly in his cells as it does in mine. And therefore he's going to do better on heavier weights than my body can take, but doing a rest heavy set if he's doing a weight training session. And he's also suited to doing long distance sort of endurance exercise like running. Contrast that to me. I've done the ultra marathons 25 years, but I was always wondering, why am I always overweight and got hormonal problems and all these different health problems? And the reason was I was doing the wrong type of exercise for my genetics. Now, that doesn't mean I can never do an ultra, but it surely means that I shouldn't have been doing them back to back like I did do. Not if I want optimal health, and I've had to undo a lot of the damage that I did, you know, by doing all that. So this old adage of calories in and calories out, for example, is complete nonsense. I ran through New Zealand at one stage, like 2,250 kilometres in 42 days. I was running 500 kilometres a week, and I got fatter. Like, if that was calories in, calories out, then I should have been a stick figure.
Yeah.
I wasn't. I put on weight during that time. I lost a lot of muscle mass, and I ended up slowing my metabolism down. And the reason was I was overtraining. My body was in complete burnout and stress, and it was holding on to everything it could possibly get hold of, because it was like, well, we're in deep, deep trouble here. Something's wrong. I'm going to hold everything, you know. So understanding that now, I'm very, very lean, very low body fat, but good muscle composition at levels that I could never achieve when I was doing ultra marathons, because I'm not doing ultra marathons anymore, because that's not suitable for my genetics and life circumstances, mum and so on. And so that's empowering information.
Yeah.
You know, that's very empowering. And it doesn't mean that I couldn't ever do an ultra again. But I'd have to train differently for it if I was.
It's it's so good to hear you say all those things. I work as well in like a activism, body diversity, body neutrality kind of space, and getting across the message to people that your body hasn't failed, it's the diet that fails. That's a complete mind shift, and I didn't actually think about it from a genetic point of view before. So I feel like this is a whole other podcast.
that's a whole other podcast. And I'll send you a little webinar to watch on it on the program that we do, because it is empowering people to, like, as a young girl, I was a gymnast, and when I got to puberty, I grew too tall and too big, and I wasn't, I had curves, and I didn't realize, I wanted to be the skinny little model girl, and I wasn't, and I was never going to be that.
Mm.
And I spent years terrorizing myself for not being that instead of embracing the wonderfully muscular body that I have. Like now I'm like, oh, I like this, I've got muscles and I've optimized what I've got. And embracing what you genetically are and understanding who you are, and that it's okay. Like there are people who are like my mum, who are very strong boned, very stout, sturdy bodies, and they have a predisposition to weight gain and metabolic disorders, but they also have incredible strength. They have long-term endurance. They can carry heavy weights. They're very nurturing, caring individuals because they have a lot of prolactin. They have wonderful immune systems, so they're not going to get osteoporosis. So there's pros and cons to everybody's shape and every type. And she's always like, oh, well, I've always got fat legs. And I'm going, Mum, I'm very glad that you had fat legs, because after 2 years in a wheelchair, she was still able to walk because the muscle mass was still there, So don't ever say, I don't like my big legs. She's now, very glad that she had very muscular, big, strong, heavy legs, because she was still able to walk after 2 years of not walking much, and had the strength and didn't lose that muscle mass. Whereas if I was in a wheelchair for 2 years, I'd probably be in deep trouble. I wouldn't have the muscle mass to get back up again. Even though I have a muscular body, but I have a leaner muscular body. She has a much stronger joints and so on. So there's pros and cons, in other words, for every type. And you have to know the good, understand and accept the bad, and then optimize it for you.
So this is where the link to our own question of, do I just have to be fucking done with everything before I make a change, comes back into view?
You might remember earlier in the conversation, Lisa mentioned being what she called an 80% person, 80-20. It's led to one of our favourite mantras when pushing past the need for perfection and taking action in our business.
I think by nature I'm not a perfectionist. I'm an action taker. Again, genetically speaking, my dominant hormones are adrenaline, testosterone and dopamine. So I'm very much action orientated and in the now. And that, makes me just want to start whatever I'm doing, and just get on with it. But I'm hopeless at strategizing, doing systems and processes are my weakness. So it's really about understanding that in a business sense, right? I've got a number of businesses.
Mm.
If I wait until my course is perfect before I put it out into the world, you know what's going to happen? I'll put it out there and then nobody will want it because it wasn't what the people wanted. Mm. I need to understand what they need. So, you would have heard of the term minimal viable product, and that's when you get the thing out there, something, and then see, is that what direction, what people want? Or you're getting feedback from people, hey, could you improve this or change this? And that means that you're actually iterating it according to the need in your community and your audience or your followers or whatever the case is. And that's a much better approach than waiting for this perfection to happen, because then you'll never take action, because there'll be something that's not quite right, and so you won't, you get in your own way. Now, perfectionism can be really great if you're a really top level creative, I have another brother who's very much a perfectionist, and he's created the most wonderful house. Like it's a grand design's amazing thing. Now that I would never have done that, because I'd be just, you couldn't wait the 5 years to make it happen. I'd just be, getting it out there and doing it rather than this amazing creation of art that he's made basically in the form of a house. So there are advantages to it, but you know, you've got to ask yourself at what cost sometimes is that perfectionism? Is it holding you up in your career or in your development? And can you let go of it to some degree? Because if you can't, then you're liable to not actually get the experience because you're waiting for the time when this will be perfect. Like, you know, you guys doing this podcast, right? I'm sure the first time you did a podcast, or, you know, I don't know what you did previously in your careers, but the first time you interviewed somebody or did something like that, you probably sucked at it, you know, but you did it. And then you got better at it and better and better. And that is the thing, you know. None of us were born masters. We have to actually do the doing in order to become experienced. And when we're perfectionists, or like, you know, oh, I'm not going to do that interview because I'm not good enough as an interviewer. Well, how do you think you get good at it? You get good by doing. And that means you have to be happy that you're maybe not the most brilliant person from the get-go. Just as an example. So I think, yeah, perfectionism can really stress us out, take a heck of a lot of our energy and hinder us in just going ahead. And, you know, that whole 80-20 rule, I sort of, you know, roughly apply that to my whole life. If I have all these goals and if I get 80% of the way there with them, then I'm probably doing okay. Because I understand that life, we cannot control every variable. We can only control certain amounts of things. And we have to be, again, going back to that flexibility argument and discussion that we had, you know, being flexible and adaptable, you know. And it's like when you're working with someone who wants to lose weight and they fall off the bandwagon and they, you know, end up eating stuff they shouldn't have. If they're into a perfectionist in the mind, they'll be going, oh, I completely ruined it. What's the point? I'll never do it right. And then they won't get back on the bandwagon. Whereas if you have the approach of, oh, I stuffed up today and I didn't do what I was meant to do. All right, I'm going to get back on it from now on, you know, and back on the horse and back into it. And then you're more likely to, at the end of the day, get to your results, you know, get to your final results rather than going, oh, well, I might as well eat another couple of ice creams on top of that because what's the point anyway?
It also kind of sparks the question for me of how we approach mentors and going out in search of mentors. I think, you know, sometimes when I've thought about going out to find somebody to give me some help, it might be more from a point of trying to validate or trying to reach for some kind of perfectionism. So is there value in relaxing off that a little bit and just allowing a bit more exploration and not relying so much on somebody else's opinion?
Yeah, I think there is. You know, I think we just need to – I find that people that I'm meant to meet or whatever will come across my path when I'm in flow and I'm in action, I'm taking action. And instead of, again, trying to get that, you know, that perfect person or the perfect coach or the perfect whatever, but just starting wherever you are, you know, bumbling your way along until you get there, you know, and then people will come across your path. I do believe the universe puts people in our path when we need them. You know, what do they say? The right teacher will turn up when the student's ready. And that if we just trust ourselves to just keep moving forward and being open and listening to our gut sometimes. You know, since losing my father last year, I've, you know, prior to this, I wasn't, you know, not religious and not really into anything spiritual. And now, of course, I'm, where's my dad gone? You know, like, I want to know. And so I've been studying, if you like, or, you know, and reading and listening to people and going, wow, that starts to make sense. And if it's just about listening to your intuition, which, you know, I tend to believe now comes from somewhere else rather than just from our own mind, or sometimes at least, that, you know, we can tap into a power, if you like, that can guide us, you know, and I don't know that for a fact, but that's how I feel at the moment. So I'm trying to sit now, when I have a big decision to make, I'm trying to just sit with it and sort of see where my gut is telling me is the right direction to go. And, you know, the gut being whether it's my intuition or whether that's coming from a higher place, it is helping me make better, more and more good decisions. You know, like sometimes I've, in the past, where I've just gone against what my gut's telling me because I think this is a great idea, and then usually I fall on my face when I do that because there's something that I haven't picked up on, you know. And so I think, you know, trying to tune in and to become more intuitive is definitely one of my goals, which is, you know, I found that pretty hard in a way because I'm just very much, you know, I override a lot of my, you know, I'm going to just do things anyway and very disciplined as far as my training and things would go. And now I like tune into my body and go, is it ready for that training session that I had planned today, or is it actually not up for it? And now I tend to listen to my body, you know. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I can really relate to what you're saying there with that exploration you're doing as well. I lost my dad almost a year ago myself.
Oh,
and
wow.
In that time, I've looked at ancient wisdom through Huna, which is an ancient Hawaiian wisdom belief system, which, again, has connected me with intuition and so forth as well. So I wonder, you know, what is your toolkit? What are the things that you use for success and for keeping yourself moving forward?
I think I have a lot of just daily rituals that I've developed over time, little tips and tricks to keep me on track as far as my health is, you know, and working on my, you know, improving myself. So for example, if I, you know, I've got to go training, you know, like this afternoon, I've got to go out and go for a run. And at that point, I probably won't feel like it because I'll be tired and I, you know, there's a cold outside and it's raining and I don't want to, you know, and those are the normal sorts of things that we, these discussions that we have in our brains. And people tend to think when they talk to me, but, oh, but you're just naturally motivated. No, I'm not. I don't want to go out in the cold either. However, I know what my bigger picture is. I know what my why is. I understand that if I'm going to keep my body in a good shape, then I need to exercise regularly. Now, I will check in with myself and say, you know, did I have a good night's sleep? Did I hydrate well today? Did I eat relatively well? Did I not, you know, have I got any aches and pains or things that I need to be aware of? And then if my scores are not too bad on that front, then I'll go, okay, right, we can do what's on the plan today. Or if I've had a very bad night's sleep and I'm not feeling very well, then I might dial it back because I'm not going to get the adaptation if I train when I'm not well, you know. So it's a wasted training session. I'm actually putting myself backwards. So my body needs to be ready to help get that adaptation. So then some of the tricks that I use from a psychological point of view is like, because I'm self-employed and I get to do this, I'm always in my running gear. So I'm pretty
always
much
ready.
I'm always ready so that if I get a break in my schedule, I can, you know, if someone cancels or whatever, I can put my shoes on and I'm out the door. You know,
love it.
Because then I'm ready to go and I've got no excuse. So some people like, you know, come home from work and they're tired from the mental stresses and the, you know, work and kids and whatever. And they come in the door and they go, oh, crikey, I meant to go running as well. And they come in and they put on their pajamas or something. And if you put your pajamas on and relax, there is no way in hell you are getting out the door.
It's all over.
It's all over.
But Lisa, I'm sitting here in my activewear and I also have no plans on getting out of the door. It was just comfortable this morning.
Well, you know what I'd say to you is, Louise, is I'd challenge you to run to the letterbox and back, you know. And I'm serious because what happens is when you take a little mini action, motivation follows action, not the other way around. So I'll say that again. Motivation follows action. So when you actually, you're in your activewear, you've got your shoes on, and you go, well, I might as well just, you know, I'll just go for a 5-minute walk, 5 minutes. And we all go, okay, I can probably manage that. And you know, you have your argument in your head with yourself and you think, well, yeah, but I can manage this tiny micro commitment. And you do that little commitment and then you're like, oh, that wasn't so bad. Maybe I can just go for a 20-minute walk, you know. And, okay, today you may have not gone for that run, but you went for that 20-minute walk. And what you need to do then is when you get back from that 20-minute walk, you need to pat yourself on the back and go, yay, I did that, and really, like, congratulate yourself. Mm. And the reason you do that, I don't know if you know the book by BJ Fogg, is called Tiny Habits, and it's about building little building blocks to the bigger things, if you like. And when we congratulate ourselves and we go, hey, you did really well, Louise, you did awesome, you went to the letterbox and back, good on you. Yeah. Mm. And we celebrate that, then we start to associate exercise with reward in our brain. And when we do this repeatedly, it starts to become easier and easier to get out the door and to actually do it. You know, and one of the other little tricks that I do, like, you know, if I'm lying in bed and I'm meant to go for a run and it's cold and miserable out there and I don't want to get up and it's dark, and I say, well, I'll just get up and I'll put my shoes on and I'll just go for a bit of a walk, and if it's not happening, I'll just come back and go to bed. Well, you can bet your bottom dollar once you've gotten out of bed and you've put your gear on, you're very unlikely after half a mile to turn around and come home.
Mm.
And if I do, then that means I probably really needed to have a day off, you know, because once you're out there, you're in it. So remember that quote, if you take nothing away from me but this, that motivation follows action. Take a micro step towards something, you know, commit to a little bit of, you know, I'm going to do 10 press-ups. All right, cool. Or 10 squats. And you've done your little micro commitment, and then congratulate yourself. And then you start to associate that with being a good thing. And then you're more likely to be motivated to go and do a little bit more and a little bit more. And once you create a habit, and you can hold that habit for, you know, well, they're still discussing on how many days, but, or how many times, but somewhere between 30 and 60 days. Like in the first 2 weeks, there's going to be a bit of willpower involved. But after that, your neural pathways are started to be developed and it gets easier and easier. There's less resistance. And so if you can just get through that initial hard phase, when you say, like, you're starting a running program and you've never run before, the first 2 weeks are going to suck. Just understand that and don't compare yourself and don't measure it. Just congratulate yourself for having the commitment to do it today and for doing it for those first couple of weeks, and then it starts to become a habit. And then you get to a point where maybe you ran for like quarter of an hour and then afterwards you felt really good. And you started to get that endorphin high, that runner's high that people talk about. And then you start to get addicted. And then it starts to become easier and easier. And you'll still have days where you're not motivated to get out the door, but you know that that reward is on the other end of that run. And so you're willing to go through a bit of unpleasantness to get there. And then your identity starts to change and you become, I am a runner, in your own head. Mm. And then you will not drop anything that is a part of your identity. It tends to be that you, it's just like, you know, it's part of my daily routine to brush my teeth twice a day, and I won't negotiate on that. I'm not going to not brush my teeth, right?
I mean, I sometimes do.
Well, hopefully not for 3 or 4 days. And it's become part of my hygiene routine.
Yeah.
And exercise is a part of my personal hygiene routine. You know, I wouldn't go a week without exercise unless I was, you know, down with some horrific bug. But otherwise, I'm out there and I'm doing something, because that's just a non-negotiable. And people go, but I haven't got time. Well, I haven't got time either, but I prioritize that. It's all about which are your priorities. And exercise should be at your top of your priorities, because that's going to make you live longer, live healthier, feel better, have more energy, have more focus, be a better role model. I mean, there's a lot to love about it. So it becomes a part of your identity after a while.
Yeah, I think that mindset, that kind of rewarding ourselves and talking, being our own cheer squad, our own cheerleader, instead of putting ourselves down and say, oh, you only did 5 minutes, you only walked to the mailbox today. Mm. That goes across to everywhere in life, because we do. We put ourselves down and then instead of building ourselves up. And so I think if we can flip that, then we're going to be happier humans.
Exactly. And so start congratulating yourself. And it looks silly when you're doing a little fist pump and doing a bit of a dance. But I tell you, that rewiring of the brain is what you're achieving. And this is just absolute rock solid science. If you start to associate good things with that, you're going to do more of that. If you start to go, you're useless, you only ran to the letterbox and you didn't do it, then are you more motivated the next day to do it? Nah. Definitely not. So you have to start congratulating yourselves and getting that little bit of a dopamine hit.
There's some really great nuggets here from Lisa, and it would be so easy to boil the insight of putting what you've got out there and letting it grow down to the slogan of minimal viable product.
I do like that slogan, though.
I do like the slogan, but without everything behind it, we can use it because we know everything behind it. But otherwise, it's just kind of like an encouragement to just do the bare minimum if you don't actually know what's behind it, right? Yeah.
I think that's the danger, isn't it? We think when we take on those kind of evangelical slogans that promise the quick route without explaining that navigation behind it.
Quick route.
Whether we like it or not, whether we're prepared for it or not, change is going to happen. And Lisa strikes us as a very resilient and durable person, regardless of what change is in front of her.
Change is scary for all of us, and it's not that I don't have fear and anxieties, you know, but change is always going to happen. Nothing will stay the same in our lives, so we need to learn the abilities, if you like, of being agile and flexible and being able to adapt so that we don't go under and staying up, you know. Like, I mean, you will know just with technology and the pace at which the world is changing now, you know, I look at a lot of the people that I went to school with, for example, who are just not keeping up. And I'm like really fighting to keep up. And, you know, it's harder for me than it is for a 20-year-old because they've grown up with this whole, you know, world. And it's easier for me than it is, say, for my mum. Trying to teach her something in technology is just mission impossible almost, you know. So, I think that ability to just, okay, this is happening, this is changing, I have to go with it. I can't stay rigid, because if I stay rigid, I'll break, you know. So I try to be as fluid as possible in my life, so that I can move with the times. I can adapt to the situations that I've, you know, unfortunately faced some big crises in my life. And you're thrown into the situation sometimes. And if you have a very rigid, no, this is the way I've always done it, this is the way I'm going to keep doing it, it's not a growth mindset either, you know. Like, I'm constantly insatiably learning. That's, you know, I'm always studying, I'm always trying to keep up with the latest in health science and biohacking and the stuff that I'm interested in, and trying to improve my life, my performance, my business, you know, in all areas. I'm pursuing excellence. Haven't reached there yet, I might add, but I have that drive to do that. And I think, you know, being able to adapt to change is a really important skill. And I liken it to, it's resilience, basically. It's that, if anything, you know, I try to develop resilience.
Lisa's such an inquisitive person when it comes to looking after her health, and she's all too willing to share the research with us and for all of us to share in her inquiry.
Yeah, her podcast, Pushing the Limits, searches the world for experts in health, biohacking, high performance, mindset, fitness, longevity and health science. It's available on your podcast app too. So why not bookmark her right after you've bookmarked us? We've left a link to that and some of her other resources in this episode's show notes.
And next time on Reframe of Mind, we delve deeper in the process of decision making. And if you've been listening to the series so far, you'll be familiar with the term Joe Bomb.
In which the science here professor from the University of New South Wales, Joe Forgas, delivers us home truths to snap us out of the toxic positivity trap.
And he's got plenty more to add next time, including how we tend to summarise information in our habit of confirmation bias.
We like to summarise intuitive wisdom into short little statements, and we do not realise that if we looked further, we would find exactly the opposite occurs just as often.
You've been hearing our story, and now we really want to hear yours.
Connect with @ReframeOfMind on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok and Twitter.
Or connect with @WelcomeChangeMedia on LinkedIn.
You can also contact us via reframeofmind.com.au with your stories or suggestions for future topics.
We'd like to thank today's guests for sharing their personal stories and insights. For more information on any of the subjects, guests or references used in this episode, please see our show notes or reframeofmind.com.au.
Reframe of Mind is a Welcome Change Media production.
Tired of ads interrupting your favorite show? Good news. Ad-free listening on Amazon Music is included with your Prime membership. Download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/adfreesports. That's amazon.com/adfreesports to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Enjoy thousands of Acast shows ad-free for Prime members. Some shows may have ads.
Inflation, student debt, recession, mortgage rates. Your employees have a lot on their minds. Offer them financial well-being support from Vanguard while on your way at institutional.vanguard.com. All investing is subject to risk. Advice provided by Vanguard Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor.